Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And coming up in this edition of Africa Link, after Zimbabwe, the UN focuses on Somalia's food security situation.
In all of the regions, 18 regions, there are 953,000 people in need of urgent assistance.
Nigerians protest a spike in the cost of electricity, even as supply remains unreliable.
I'm not paying for light, I'm paying for darkness. They're asking me to pay for not having light, that's why we say no.
Plus, rights group Amnesty International call on the strengthening of UN peacekeeping mission in Central African Republic. It's Tuesday, the 9th of February. Welcome to the program with me, Crispin Mwakideo, in Bonn.
Top story.
We begin with the food security situation in East and Southern Africa. The United Nations has said nearly 40% of the Somali population are in need of humanitarian assistance. But before we go there, let's head down south to Zimbabwe, where government officials held a meeting with potential domestic and international donors. Zimbabwe is appealing for food aid for more than 2 million people. From Harare, Columbus Mavunga reports.
On Monday, Public Works Minister Xavier Kasukwere said he met domestic and international funders to avert hunger in Zimbabwe. He explains to me the purpose of that meeting.
What we have put out here is an appeal, is a declaration of the state of disaster with the specific regards to the El Nino phenomenon that is induced drought disaster for the 2015-2016. Season.
How much money are we looking at?
Well, we're still working on the numbers, and I'm sure we'll be able to give the world locally and, of course, outside kind of an estimate of what we're looking at. But we realize there's quite a number in terms of our ZIMVAC report. I've now fallen into the drought situation where we need to secure the people in terms of their food requirements until the end of season, and of course hopefully that the situation will have improved.
Food shortages have become a common feature in Zimbabwe, a country which was once the breadbasket of Southern Africa. The country, since early 2000s, has mainly relied on food handouts from organizations such as the World Food Programme, WFP, and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO. Chimimba David Piri, FAO coordinator for Southern Africa, said Zimbabwe was likely to revise its number of people who needed food assistance from the current 2.44 million. He has been on a week-long around the country assessing the food situation.
It is a very, very serious situation. This may be even a worse situation than a very bad situation that took place in 1991-1992. It is very sad that this drought will cause a lot of pain. Okay, the government made an update of the number of food insecure people recently, which they put at 2.4 million people. But now we have every reason to believe that even this 2.4 million people might be underestimated.
The UN official said more people are likely to experience food shortages that would go to year 2017. The state of disaster declared on Friday came barely 2 months after President Robert Mugabe scoffed at FAO's estimates of 1.3 million Zimbabweans facing hunger in December. Mugabe then said the country had food reserves to last more than 10 months. The Zimbabwean government has expressed commitment to minimize the impact of the drought on both humans and livestock. At least 16,500 cattle have died and 75% of crops failed. That's according to estimates of the Zimbabwean government.
Columbus Mavunga in Harare. And for more in-depth analysis on the food security situation in Zimbabwe, visit our webpage dw.com/Africa. The United Nations 2016 humanitarian response for Somalia is seeking $885 million. The money would be used to address the most urgent needs of nearly 5 million people. Puntland and Somaliland have been hard hit by drought, exacerbated by the El Nino phenomena. The situation has been made worse by people fleeing Al-Shabaab violence. That's according to a statement released by the UN Food Agency, FAO, in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. James Chimanyula attended the briefing and filed this report.
According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, the food insecurity in Somalia has been compounded by poor rainfall and drought conditions in its 18 regions, including patches of the southern part of the country controlled by Al-Shabaab militants. Speaking at a press conference in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Daniel Mola, FAO's food security and nutrition analyst for Somalia, said many people are in need of food aid, while more than 300,000 children are malnourished.
There are 953,000 people in need of urgent assistance in all of the regions, 18 regions. These are people experiencing acute food security crisis and emergency. Insecurity tends to be worse in the south. Of course, the situation gets complicated whenever we have military operations. People tend to run away from those areas affected by aspect of conflict in the lead up to the operation out of fear, concern, or right after a military operation. Marka represents one of the areas where we monitor in southern Somalia. It's in the Shabelle region. And of course, because of its proximity to Mogadishu, it has important trade linkages. Now I understand AMISOM and the Somali forces have moved back and taken over without any major confrontation.
Maka, the third largest port in Somalia after Mogadishu and Kismayo, fell into the hands of Al-Shabaab last week before it was recaptured by AMISOM troops earlier this week. Head of FAO programs, Ruud van Aken, talked about their operations in Somalia.
We've always managed to operate in Somalia throughout, in good times and bad times. We have in every district food security specialists who work in their own home area. For implementing our programs, we either have our own staff on the ground or we have NGO partners with whom we are working long time. And we, of course, we have government. At least they facilitate our access into the areas.
Highlighting challenges facing the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Somalia, Marwo Sophie Gade-Thomi, its Somali coordinator, had this to sum it up.
Somalia is one of the most challenging operating environment for humanitarians, but we do manage to find ways to still deliver humanitarian assistance, 18 regions, but the situation is quite fluid also, and it all depends on the type of programs that we're looking at. Some programs will need a more sort of short-term people on the ground. Southern and central Somalia has definitely been the most problematic in terms of insecurity, but also because of the condition of roads and just the general infrastructure. Means that we often rely on using air assets or using planes and helicopters and so forth in areas where we would otherwise be able to go by road if the roads were better. Somalia is one of the areas where we put a lot of effort into mitigating the risk, ensuring that we continue to expand access and try to reach the people in need in spite of the very difficult security situation.
That report was compiled by James Chimanyula in Nairobi.
News, analysis and feature reports, all that here on Africa Link.
To the Central African Republic now, where rights group Amnesty International has called for the strengthening of MINUSCA, the UN peacekeeping force. Amnesty made the remarks in a report released on Monday. The report analyzes how major gaps in personnel and equipment resulted in the failure by the Blue Helmets to prevent the September 2015 violence. 75 people were killed and 42,000 displaced. Jane Ayeko-Kumeth has been speaking to Steve Coban, co-author of the report, to find out other weaknesses of MINUSCA.
It's important to be clear that the UN peacekeepers MINUSCA have done and are still doing a really important job in Central African Republic. They have saved many lives, they prevented much bloodshed, they prevented the conflict from getting worse and from degenerating further. But, you know, we and others have been concerned for some time about some significant gaps in the capacity to protect civilians is from large-scale outbreaks of violence. So in September 2015, there was some of the worst violence that the country saw since early 2014, which, you know, has led to the death of over 75 people, displacement of 42,000 others, many rapes, and also the escape of over 500 prisoners from the main prison. And this to us was an example of where some of the long-standing weaknesses of MINUSCA had been exposed, and of course makes us worry that unless measures are taken, it could be exposed again.
Now, from what you just say, it appears that MINUSCA's presence in CAR has been a mixture of success but also failure. What is the biggest weakness of the troops?
First of all, it was fairly clear that there have been too few troops and police in the country to be able to manage what is a very large country, very spread out, and a lot of different challenges. And although there have been some reinforcements sent since September, the big question still remains about whether there are enough personnel. And especially when you consider the French forces announced that they will leave, or the majority of them will leave before the end of the year. But just as importantly, there's an issue about, you know, a number of contingents, a number of different national forces in the country not performing to the standards that the UN would expect. Many lacking very important equipment or training that they would need to be able to do their job in such an environment. In some cases, you even had, you know, battalions of soldiers who hadn't received their salaries for months. You know, things like that that really prevent, even that when numbers of forces have been deployed, that they were not effective, motivated, disciplined to do the job that they're supposed to do. So there's a number of things like that we detail out in the report. You know, MINUSCA have taken some measures to be able to try and overcome some of these gaps in the short term. There has been a period of a relative calm, but you know, we certainly think that much more needs to be done by the international community to strengthen MINUSCA if we want to make sure that the force will be able to protect civilians and really help the country turn the page on its past.
Much as you're talking about strengthening the force in Central African Republic, there have also been allegations of the Blue Boys having been involved in human rights violations, some of which are actually highlighted in your report, including raping women. There is also growing suspicion and hostility towards MINUSCA as people lose hope in the force because every time they're looking forward to help, they're not so quick to help them. Now, how can we be sure that history will not repeat itself?
The issue of sexual abuse and other abuses by peacekeepers is absolutely critical, not just for the credibility of the peacekeeping force, but even more so to make sure that the victims are supported, that we prevent these kind of crimes, and that that justice is done in the same way. So whilst we're calling for troops to be reinforced, there has to be, in parallel, also a serious effort. And we're starting to see more of this by the UN, to be fair, but a serious effort to put an end to these practices, to stamp out these practices. And for us, that means it needs to be accountability.
Amnesty International's Deputy Director for West and Central Africa, Steve Coburn.
Africa on the move.
Once upon a time, Zanzibar became rich from the sale of spices to the world. But the Tanzanian spices industry broke down in the 1960s when nationalization scared away investors, never to completely recover again. But the story didn't end there. Now, a few spice farmers are seeking to change that with the help of two German entrepreneurs. This report by Wiebke Feuerzenger is now presented by Abubakar Jallo.
Girl, I just drink black tea.
Lantana, also the flower.
In Zanzibar, you will find almost all the spices in the world. Cloves, nutmeg, lemongrass, cardamom, cinnamon, vanilla, saffron and ginger are some of the more common ones. But nobody is getting rich on the sale of spices anymore. Most farmers depend more on the visit of tourists than on their crops to survive. Many have given up and found other jobs, but some like farmer Patrick Maganga and one of his neighbors found a way to thrive in a difficult market. Among the spice farmers of Zanzibar, Maganga is considered an expert. Everybody comes to him to buy new seedlings.
I think it is because I use cow dung manure exclusively and select the plants very carefully.
Together with another 30 spice farmers, Maganga founded a cooperative, Zanzibar Organic Spices Growers. Now the farmers share everything, tools, strength, and above all, knowledge. United, they found a way to expand. Cloves are now grown on a large scale. Maganga's neighbor, Ali Farm, reveals the secrets of their success.
We decided to be certified organic. And when we sell to our customer as organic, the price is increased. Yeah, from 15 to 20,000 shillings.
Zanzibar has been producing spices for over 1,000 years, without pesticides and without artificial fertilizers. But traditional spice farming had to face globalization. The farmers could not compete with cheap cloves from Colombia or the massive Chinese farms of cinnamon and cardamom. Forming a cooperative helped to ease things a little. The cooperative works with young company based in Stone Town that buys organic products from the island. The company called Zang Spice picks all the spices by hand and then ships them to Europe under the label 1001 Organic. Zang Spice was founded in 2012 by two Germans, entrepreneur Michael Hintjes and development worker Friedman Gille. But it was a long journey until selling directly to Europe and obtaining an organic certificate. Storage facilities had to be found, transport hired, and an official expert from Germany had to be flown in. But now, thanks to the additional income, Patrick Maganga has been able to build a new house. His wife is very pleased with him.
I'm so proud of him. Life is much easier than before, and the family gets everything it needs.
That report was written by Vipke Foyazenga. Leaving the Zanzibar spices behind, let's go to Nigeria, where thousands of angry workers took to the streets on Monday. Many Nigerians are wondering why they are being asked to pay more for electricity when the power companies are not living up to expectations. Nigeria suffers frequent power failure, and many of its citizens have to rely on electricity generators at home and to run their businesses. The protests organized by Nigeria's Labour Congress and the Trade Union Congress are seen as the first major test for President Muhammadu Buhari. Samuel Okoya witnessed the march in Lagos and sent us this report.
These are some of the workers and members of civil society groups picketing the premises of the Ikeja Electricity Distribution Company. This is one of the largest power distribution companies in Nigeria. The protesters are here to express their anger at the 45% increase in electricity tariff. Scenarios like this were played out across the entire country. Ismail Bello of the Nigeria Labour Congress, the umbrella workers' union which organized the nationwide protest, says workers and Nigerians in general cannot pay for higher electricity tariff in the face of rising inflation in the country.
We cannot even understand why the decision to increase electricity tariff at this material time, when wages are extremely very low to cope with the rising cost of living. Transportation is on the rise. Many workers can't pay their children's school fees. Housing cost is rising. Food cost is rising. And yet government is determined to increase electricity bill by 50%. So how would the worker cope?
We cannot move forward with these people who are just exploiting Nigeria.
An angry labor leader addresses the crowd. Many here cannot understand why they have to pay more for electricity in a country that suffers serious power outages. Yet the companies now want to make consumers pay more for electricity, even though sometimes people have to go for weeks or even months without power. This is done under a system where the electricity company charge customers not for the electricity they used, but on what they are assumed to have used. Ime Ikechukwu, who joined the protest, said paying more for power amounts to paying more for darkness.
I'm not paying for light, I'm paying for darkness. They're asking me to pay for not having light. That's why we say no. Let us get it properly. Let us get it right. By the time you get it, everything right, whatever thing you say, we can pay as a NEPA bill. Anybody can be happy to pay.
Aigbe Olotu, an official of the Ikeja Electricity Distribution Company, says the company is doing its best.
I can tell you that we are not resting on our house, and we are working assiduously on it to deliver what we believe will bring succor to all Nigerians, all consumers of electricity.
Unaccepted! Unaccepted!
We have always told you before, we have always told our consumers.
But his speech got interrupted as an argument ensued between him and the angry crowd. This is the first major protest the government of President Muhammadu Buhari will face since coming to power in May last year. Nigeria's electricity situation represents one of the decays in the country. In spite of the billions of dollars spent on the sector in previous years, electricity supply in the country remains epileptic.
Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Making a difference.
History is being made in Ghana after one of the main political parties chose its first person living with disability to run for the highest office. Ivor Greenstreet won the candidature of his party, the Convention People's Party, founded by the country's first president, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. Although Greenstreet provides some inspiration to those hoping for a change in government, many consider it a daunting task for him to make a major impact. Nevertheless, as Isaac Kalechi in Accra reports, Greenstreet is making a difference.
Since Ghana returned to democratic rule in 1992, the country has had only two major political parties forming a government, the ruling National Democratic Congress, NDC, and the opposition New Patriotic Party, NPP. Other smaller parties, including the Convention People's Party, which derives its inspiration from Ghana's first president, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, have hardly made any significant impact during general elections, consistently pulling less than 1% of total votes cast. More than 20 years down the line, most Ghanaians are still unhappy and want more from their government. Changing this trend is what got the newly elected presidential candidate of the CPP, Ivor Greenstreet, into politics.
Ghanaians are not happy with these two other larger parties. Ghanaians are not happy with the current, you know, conditions in which they find themselves in their daily lives in terms of how the institutions of the nation work for them or don't work for them, as the case may be. So certainly the ground is very, very fertile for us to take advantage of this new energy, this new spirit, this desire for rejuvenation.
Greenstreet's focus is to maximize the strength of his party's youth towards fixing the problems of Ghana should he be elected the country's next president. Priority for him is to get the teeming unemployed youth into work. Some of those youth supporting him believe he can deliver.
He reflects the ideas of the young people in this country. If you listen to the message that he's putting across, especially addressing youth unemployment in this country, how to first and foremost build the capacity of young people, develop skills of young people, introduce e-learning into our school curriculum.
I mean, getting somebody who has love for the youth. I have known Ivor, aside politics, I've known him for the past 15 years, and he's someone who is always in for the youth. He's someone who always wants to inspire the youth.
In spite of the inspiration Greenstreet provides, ordinary voters in Ghana say the challenge is daunting for him.
Up to how our elections are going, I don't think we have any chance. It is still going to be between the NPP and NDC.
Well, I don't think he has a chance becoming president because Ghanaians are just used to the two biggest parties in Ghana, NPP and NDC.
He has a chance. By the way Ghana politics is, it will be very difficult for him to stand between the two.
But Greenstreet isn't discouraged. He is working hard towards November 7 and just the fight to change the voting pattern in Ghana alone keeps him going.
And incredibly, you get inspired by the whole process because you know that, you know, you're on a journey that is going to, in your own perspective, deliver, you know, a better life to so many human beings nationwide. And that is a great prospect, which, you know, makes you so inspired and energized every day of the week.
Election watchers await November 7 to witness what impact Greenstreet could make.
Isaac Kalechi in Accra. And now a reminder of our main stories. The UN has described the food situation in Somalia as critical. Workers in Nigeria have protested against an increase in electricity bills. And we've also been hearing about the first potential presidential candidate in Ghana who is living with disability. And there we come to the end of another edition of Africa Link. To send us your comments and suggestions on the program, by text message to 491609575950 or an email to feedback.africa@dw.com. I'm Crispin Mwakideu. Have a lovely day.